help with drug rounds? For God's sake. He knows instantly what I'm thinking. Those drugs are locked away. You have to be a qualified nurse even to push the trolley around. She just used to sit with people, make friends. Did she meet her? A sudden new suspicion flashes in front of me. Meet who? Your girlfriend, Beth. She's not my girlfriend now. It's over. He gets up and stands with his back to me. He looks out of the kitchen window into the garden where the rain is now falling in dark sheets. And the answer to your question is no. How do you know? He shrugs. She was never around when I picked up Naomi. She often worked late shifts. Beth would have seen Naomi, despite what Ted says. She might have wondered what it would be like to have a child of Ted's, might have played with the idea that Naomi was hers. The thought takes hold. Where's she now? Who? He asks again. For Christ's sake, Ted, Beth! Perhaps it's her all along. She's got Naomi because she belongs to you and... Stop! He raises himself on tiptoes and lowers again, hands deep in his pockets. He looks calm except for the fact that his hands are clenched so tightly the trousers are stretched over them. I can see the knuckles through the thick cotton. You know she was with me the night Naomi disappeared. He says it quietly. I know that's what you told me. She was in her flat. She has an excellent alibi. Is he talking about himself? He turns and catches my glance. Not me. The police. I can see he's still hiding something. She called them because someone broke into her flat that night. He pauses for a fraction. Then she called me.
She called you?
My mind begins to jump down steps to a place I hadn't seen before.
So you weren't there for the first time, making a mistake because you were tired and drunk? You were already lovers. God, I've been even more stupid than I realised.
I haven't had a chance to explain anything.
How long does it take to tell someone you've lied? Minutes? Months? Years?
I put down my mug of tea. It tastes unpleasantly flat.
I already knew it carried on after you told me it had ended. I hadn't realised you were lying about when it started as well.
How could I tell you, with Naomi gone? He has turned to face me. I ignore his question. Push away the past lies and the future ones. I need to keep focused.
Beth called the police and then you because her flat had been burgled.
I speak slowly, working it out for myself.
The police should have made the connection later that Beth's lover was Naomi's father, and her flat had been vandalised the night Naomi disappeared. This is important. Why didn't Michael tell me then?
He didn't know. Ted sits again, facing me across the table. The police didn't find out I was with Beth till later, when I went to tell them at the station. That night I waited, parked further down the street from her flat, until the police had gone.
What had he been thinking as he hid there in the dark street? Was he ashamed? Perhaps he had been thinking about his research or the operation that had gone wrong. No, he must have been thinking about Beth, about sex with Beth later, once the police had left. Of course, I said. Stupid me again. It had to be secret. I was going to end it. This isn't the point, I tell myself. None of this is. There's something I'm missing. What were you doing when she phoned you? I start at the beginning again, one thread at a time.
Getting into the car. I was bloody exhausted that evening. He shakes his head at the memory. The court case had just crumbled and I was wiped out. I was so relieved that the scheduled op wasn't going ahead. All I could think about was coming home. I'd even forgotten whether I had to pick Naomi up or not.
This has the ring of truth, and I believe him.
Then I got Beth's call. She was distraught and frightened. The flat had been trashed. They had even set fire to the kitchen.
A faint memory of the scent of burning floats past me. How Ted had stood in the hall 13 months ago, and I had smelt burning on him. I thought it was the diathermy he'd used in the operation. Then I forgot that instantly in the overarching fear of that night.
They? More than one, then?
The police apparently thought it was a gang of some kind, maybe kids. Even when they knew about my connection with Beth, they didn't think it was in any way related to Naomi's disappearance.
What did they take?
Nothing seemed to have been taken.
Ted shrugs. He has accepted the strangeness by now.
Her laptop, television, camera, jewellery. It was all there, jumbled up, but there.
Doesn't that strike you as odd? The night that Naomi disappeared.
I look at him, but he shakes his head. Break-ins happen all over Bristol every night. Ted sounds weary.
A thin child with bruises and tiredness. That combination hadn't been a coincidence either, or even child abuse. Jade had had leukemia.
Did Naomi really never see you and Beth together? It's getting difficult to sit still. I get up and rinse the cups, turning my hands in the water to warm them.
No, I just told you.
Then he stops, as if a memory has caught him.
Actually, thinking back, that's not strictly true. Beth came into my office once, but she saw Naomi and left again. Naomi didn't even register.
He was wrong. Naomi would have smelt Beth's lavender scent as she came in. She would have lifted her head and might have been puzzled at its familiarity until she remembered she had smelt it on her father's skin. She would have pretended to look out of Ted's window, the narrow one above the desk with the peacock pattern curtains that I sewed years ago. At the same time, she would be watching Beth out of the corner of her eye, so she would have caught the tiny glance between Beth and Ted.
Naomi would have registered almost instantly.
I'll need to phone Michael to let him know.
Are you still in touch?
I thought of his warm hands and serious eyes, touching his mouth with my mouth.
Yes.
I looked down, then away.
Why should I tell him about Michael? I owe Ted nothing now.
You'll need to stay and see him, if he agrees to come here.
Of course. Look, Jenny.
I do look at him then, and beyond the known shape of him, the new stubble, and the unfamiliar nicotine stains on his fingers, the longer hair, and the reassuring smile, I see a middle-aged man grown older, tired, and bitter, as if he knows he had made mistakes and wishes he hadn't.
I meant what I said. It's really over with Beth now.
They do food in the pub, I say. Come back when you need to sleep.
After he leaves, I try to phone Michael, but he doesn't pick up. I go to the shed. It feels cold and looks messy. Usually I don't notice the mess. I haven't the heart to start painting, so I tidy jumbled seeds and rosehips. But I don't dream about them that night. Instead, in my dreams, I see Naomi throwing broken glass at the walls of Beth's burnt kitchen and laughing. The laughter wakes me and changes into the cry of a gull, calling in the night from its perch on the roof. I lie in the dark. The landscape of the past has changed. Naomi. Ketamine. Beth's break-in. My mind goes round and round. How had I missed so much? But I know how easy it is to miss things. I hadn't seen what was happening to Ed. It could easily have been too late for him as well. I gave up the attempt to sleep again. I get up, go downstairs in the dark, and make tea. My sketchbook is on the side, but it's face down, left open. Did Ted flick through it quickly or study each picture in turn? Perhaps he was disappointed there are none of him. His wet coat is over the chair. The sleeves have dripped a little pool of water on the floor. I didn't hear him come in from the pub and go upstairs. I open the door to the garden and look into the black quietness. The storm that came in from the sea has already gone again. I shut the door and sit on the floor with my back against the wood burner, the mug of tea beside me. Scalpels are easy to draw. Harder to capture the holding fingers. Impossible to show how they were trembling.
Bristol, 2009. 11 days after. Ed pulled his arm back and shook his sleeve down. He turned his head away, and in the downward curve of his thin neck, I saw how far away he had gone. I put my arms round him. I could feel him shivering.
"What's happened to you?"
He shrugged and moved away.
"I'm not angry."
But I didn't think he heard. It was true, though. "I want to help." He walked into the sitting room and sat down on the sofa, put his head back and stared at the ceiling. I sat beside him. "Can you tell me what's been going on?" He looked at me suddenly, brown eyes staring hotly into mine.
"Don't you fucking dare tell Dad!"
"Were you using drugs from my medical bag?" No answer. There aren't enough in there to do this. I touched his inner elbow lightly as I spoke, but he gasped and wrenched his arm back. I had felt a swelling under my fingers, hot through the cotton of the shirt. "I'm going to make a sandwich and a cup of coffee for both of us." Perhaps this was how you did it, by pretending to be calm and sensible, although when I saw his face drawn with pain, I wanted to weep. "There might be an abscess there, Ed. I could take a look in a while." We ate in silence, which didn't seem to bother him. He stared blankly out of the window as he chewed. Then as we drank coffee, I began carefully. "How are you feeling now?" He glanced at me quickly, contemptuously.
"Like shit. What do you think?"
"How long?"
"Dunno."
He shrugged. "How often?"
"Whenever."
But his shoulders went down as though talking was loosening something in him. "What have you been taking?"
"Different stuff."
A pause, then a low mutter that I had to lean in to catch.
"Ketamine, mostly."
The danger he's been in makes me feel sick. "Where from?" He looked sideways at me and then smiled scornfully.
"Man in a club."
"Where are you going with this?"
"How the hell should I know?"
"Why drugs, Ed?"
He screwed up his eyes. "Because of all the other shit."
"What other shit?"
"Stuff."
"Like?"
"Theo," he said in a low voice. "Naomi."
"Theo?" The drugs might help with the guilt he felt about Naomi, although some scars looked old, so he must have been taking them even before she disappeared. How did Theo fit in?
"Leave it, Mum."
He started jigging his leg up and down. I looked around the room as though the tools to unlock this were somewhere, lying on the sideboard or just out of reach on a high shelf. "It wasn't your fault she was taken. We told you that. Even if you'd waited..."
"I said leave it."
"The money?"
He was silent.
"Ed, where did the money come from?" The jigging got faster and faster. Then he got up suddenly and went to the stairs. "Where are you going?"
"The fucking North Pole."
I waited until his bedroom door shut. Then I sat down, and the room seemed to lower itself around me. There was a quiet ringing in the air, like after an explosion, but it was inside my head. I looked at my hands on the table. The tendons shone through the skin in pale ridges. They were thinner hands now, but still strong. I had delivered babies, inserted catheters and drips, sewn torn skin, held the foreheads of my vomiting children. I clenched them tightly. I could grasp this. I had to. He was sitting with his back against his bedhead, earphones in. His bent knees supported a book, and as I came in, he began turning the pages quickly. I sat on his bed and he moved his legs sharply away. Some parents might involve the school. Some might involve the school and the police. The pages stopped turning, but he didn't look up. Lots of parents would insist on being told the details of what's been happening. I'm offering a deal. He pulled out his earphones and waited. If you agree to go to a rehabilitation unit, then we won't involve the school or the police. And as long as you talk to someone and you stop, then you needn't tell us anything about where the drugs came from or the money I saw. He stared at me silently. Then he looked down at the book on his lap, but his eyes weren't moving.
"Just leave school?"
"Yes, so you can go to a rehab unit." He lay back and closed his eyes. I gently took his arm, pushed up his sleeve, and looked at the scars. Now I could see it clearly. There was a swelling the size of a small plum tensely stretching the skin.
Ed, this needs draining. We need to go to A&E.
You do it.
I didn't argue. It might make him retreat from the bargain I had held out. I got a sterile set from the locked box in my car. Lynn used to joke that I carried an operating unit around with me, but I'd found it useful over the years for patients who needed very minor procedures and who couldn't get to hospital. It was often very satisfying, but this would be different. I found antibiotics in my bag. The thought of cutting my own son's skin made me feel weak as I walked back upstairs. I washed my hands in the bathroom in water as hot as I could stand. I knew I would hurt him. I had to find a way to deal with that so I could do this properly. I dried my hands on the paper sheet in the pack and slipped on surgical gloves. As I did so, I felt myself crossing that line, mother to doctor. This was just a problem to be solved. It was straightforward. I could do it. I cleaned his arm with an iodine swab, spread the paper above and below his elbow, positioned the cardboard receiving tray, and sprayed freezing anesthetic around and over the abscess. This will freeze it, but it will still hurt. You'd get a better anesthetic in hospital. You sure, Ed?
Do it.
Doctor, not mother. I took the scalpel and cut down sharply through the skin as it thinned over the bulging abscess. Ed shouted as the skin split neatly apart and thick yellow pus spurted out from between the cut edges, streaming over his elbow into the tray.
Jesus! Fuck!
His forehead was beaded with sweat as he watched the lumpy mess curdled with blood rise in the tray.
Fucking hell! That hurts!
Nearly done. I felt cold sweat trickle from my armpits, and with hands that I couldn't quite stop trembling, I carefully pressed the last pus out and syringed in antiseptic. Then I packed the wound with a soft yellow wick, bound it with a dressing, and watched while he swallowed a loading dose of antibiotics, penicillin, and metronidazole, paracetamol, tea. Afterwards, I sat on the bed and pinned my trembling hands tightly between my knees. Ed was white-lipped.
Don't tell Dad,
he muttered between clenched teeth. Of course he needs to know. He'll have to know why you're leaving school, if nothing else. He won't like it, but he'll understand. Even he struggled to stop smoking years ago.
I didn't know Dad used to smoke. More than cigarettes sometimes. Yeah?
Ed glanced up at me, his eyes briefly curious. Everyone's fallible. We all screw up sooner or later.
Yeah, even perfect Theo, the perfect son.
Ah. He looked down at the bed cover. I couldn't quite see his face, but his words were bitter. I waited for more, but he didn't talk about Theo again.
I sold them,
he muttered, his voice becoming indistinct.
For ketamine.
He'd been selling the drugs from my bag to buy the ones he wanted. There would probably always be someone willing to exchange pethidine and temazepam for ketamine. I leant closer as he mumbled something else. I couldn't catch what he said, and then his eyes shut and he slept. I closed the door quietly and took the tray and gloves downstairs. My mobile went off.
It'll be on the news.
The warning tone of Michael's voice put me on my guard. Ed's drugs. Someone must have found out, told a journalist. Oh, thank God he's asleep or he'll think it was me. Michael was still speaking, and it took me a few seconds to understand that what he was telling me had nothing to do with drugs.
They've found a blue pickup van, abandoned in Woodland.
26. Dorset, 2011. 13 months later. When the bathwater empties, it leaves behind a line of small stones that had worked their way into my shoes on the beach and pressed marks into my skin. I scoop them towards the plug hole.
tiny residues of sea-sharpened rock, their wet edges glint black and brown. After my bath, I go outside to phone. My voice is small in the white space of the icy garden. I keep the mobile cradled close to my mouth. Ted's window is open. He might wake and hear. As I wait for Michael to answer, the black body of a spider, suspended by a thread from the coping, swings like a beady pendulum towards the stone of the garden wall. Michael's voice lifts with surprise when he hears me. Ted's still here. I push the spider with my fingertip towards the wall, and it clings to the rough surface.
Ah.
He was ill after he arrived, so...
So you're looking after him?
Michael finishes. I've let him stay. He told me things about Naomi I didn't know. She had stolen drugs.
There is silence for a few seconds. Right, he says quietly.
It was when she was doing work experience in Ted's animal lab. She left her bag behind one day and Ted found some vials in it. The words come out smoothly enough, but I feel breathless as I say them.
Why didn't he tell anyone?
He told a policeman at the station, but it obviously wasn't followed up. The spider scuttles over the stone, searching for somewhere to hide.
But he didn't tell you, he says factually.
Apparently he didn't want to burden me with something that seemed irrelevant. A pause, then his calm voice again.
Okay. What drugs?
Ketamine. As if on cue, the air fills with the ordered fall of pealing bells. Early morning bell-ringing practice spills innocently into the gaps and empty corners of the village, bringing with the sound a world of holidays, sunshine, striped lawns and Sunday lunch. Ted used it to anaesthetize experimental rats. Naomi was in the lab and had access to it. It's not a controlled drug and they trusted her. The spider has vanished. I must have missed the moment when it dived into a gap between the stones.
There's a big trade in ketamine, Michael says slowly.
Naomi wouldn't have been involved in that. Ed traded drugs, not Naomi. Michael continues as if I haven't spoken.
I can get a list of users.
A list of users? Ted says she just took a few vials for friends.
Users of ketamine are usually older than Naomi, he interrupts. Less likely to be schoolchildren. She may have had other contacts.
That word opens a crack into the world which Ed had visited, where shadowy figures live in a network at the dark edges of life, organized and predatory. Contacts. The word for the partners of a patient who has chlamydia or gonorrhea, someone unknown, with the power to maim in secret.
At least we know what the K in her diary stands for now, Michael says.
I thought it was shorthand for coursework. How naive I've been. Naomi must have thought so too as she hugged her secrets to herself.
I'll come to you, Michael says.
Can you? Tears sting my eyes.
I'll be there in 2 hours. It would be helpful to talk to Ted too.
Thank you. I want another word that says more, something bigger, but I can't find it. I remember to warn him. He doesn't know about us.
No, he mustn't know.
Perhaps he could be withdrawn from our case if it's known we are together, or he might be dismissed. This secrecy puts a weight on our relationship, flattening it somehow. Sometimes when I'm alone, I think I have imagined it completely. After our conversation finishes, I put my hand on the wall. The surface is rough and cold. The dark crevices must be full of spiders you never see, thick with webs and trapped things. My feet leave hardened patches in the stiff white grass as I walk back to the cottage. The air is clear and cold. It will be a day of sun and ice underfoot. I let Bertie out and he rolls in the frost. His body melts the ice. When he stands and shakes himself, there is a large uneven patch of green on the white lawn. The difference in the garden excites him. He seems to like the cold penetrating to his skin. He runs in circles like a puppy. In the kitchen,
Ted is making a cup of coffee. He looks different from when he arrived. Slightly fatter, maybe, more upright. He is wearing his coat and a small case is by his feet. His eyes slide away from mine, then back again, like those of a guilty child. "I'm sorry," he says. He gives me the cup of coffee he has just made and spoons grains into another. He carries on talking quickly, as if he thinks I might interrupt him before he can say what he has planned. "She loved you." I don't need him to tell me this. I curl my hands round the mug and lean against the draining board. The sun streams through the glass and lies in bright divided blocks on the floor, showing up the dust and stains at the edges.
"I did so many things wrong," he goes on, stumbling over his words in the silence.
"What exactly?" I reach into the cupboard and then tip porridge into a pan. But I know there isn't an exactly. Everything I got wrong was somewhere in the shifting space between expecting too much and not seeing enough. Away. Busy. How can he think it's that simple? That the reason Naomi went missing was because he was busy, as if all the other things he'd done and hadn't done didn't matter. What about the rules you broke? I measure water into the oats, my hands shaking with anger. So that she thought rules didn't matter. I look at him, catching his small impatient shrug.
If you mean Beth, I told you. Naomi didn't know. I was careful.
He adds, as if it follows,
you know, it really is all over between us.
He moves closer, looks over my shoulder.
Why not put some milk with that? Makes it nicer.
Michael's coming. I move a step away, adding a half cup more water.
I've got an operating list tomorrow, so I've got to go back to see my patients. After that, I thought perhaps we...
I spoke to him this morning. I don't look at him as I stir. He's coming to talk to us about the ketamine. I scrape the porridge into a bowl and put it on the table for him.
I'll wait then.
He speaks slowly, watching me. The air in the kitchen feels tight with words that aren't being said. I'm going to work for a while, I tell him, and shut the door. It's the wrong time of year for the flowers I need for my circle, but there may be something in the hedge in the field. My sleeve snags as I open the gate. A single frozen rosebud hangs by a blackened stem from the thorny branch which has hooked me. The outer layers must have died first. The tender inner ones later. I disentangle myself, and the bud and its attached stem come off in my hand. The spider's web between the head and the stem stretches fractionally, then breaks. Inside the shed, the rosebud defines itself on thick white paper. The petals are dark and stiff at their edges, which are folded back in tiny ragged collars. Some of the petals are pink near the calyx, but stained with spots and lines of mauve and deep brown. They are still tightly cupped in layers that meet at a point. If I start with pink for the petals, and then overlay it with black, I might get the glazed ash colour. I don't want Blake's poem in my head, but as I work, the words are there anyway, as if they have been waiting for me. O Rose, thou art sick. The invisible worm that flies in the night in the howling storm. 13 months ago, her world was safe. Home, school, friends. Now I know beyond that lit circle, the world was full of hidden danger, waiting for someone to step outside into the dark shadows. It would only take one person, one contact. Has found out thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love. Does thy life destroy? I try to paint, to focus down so hard that all I see are dark colours and curved shapes. If someone loved her, surely they wouldn't destroy her. I shape the outline of the bud, and my mind is so full that when the door creaks open, I spin round, surprised.
I'm sorry, I've done it again.
Michael is wearing a coat and scarf. His car keys are in his hand. He guessed I would be here,
and came straight across the lawn. His broad shoulders curve a little, as if he is offering himself as a safe place. I touch his face, and the skin is warm under my fingers. It's good to see you. He turns his lips into my hand.
You look tired. I should have come sooner, but I thought you had the boys here.
They left a few days ago. Come into the house or Ted will come and look for us.
Ted has laid out knives on the draining board like in an operating theatre. There are neat heaps of chopped onions, little piles of spices, sliced parsnip. As we go into the kitchen, he is holding the blade tip of the knife down with one hand and seesawing the handle rapidly with the other, mincing green strands of parsley. His coat and case are nowhere in sight.
I want her to have a nourishing meal, he tells Michael after they've shaken hands. She's been looking after me, and now I need to look after her.
As though he has sensed our closeness and is trying to reclaim me. He stirs the contents of the pan. Michael goes through to the sitting room.
Why don't you both come and sit down?
Ted pulls the pan off the heat and follows us in, sits down next to me, a little too close, and puts his arm along the back of the sofa. Michael takes the chair opposite and leans forward, intent and professional, looking at us.
When Jenny mentioned ketamine to me, I ran a check. Our software enables us to access national lists of known users and dealers, and we can cross-correlate with other crimes committed as well.
Crimes like kidnapping or crimes like rape and murder. I glance at Ted to see if he is thinking this too, but his head is down, absorbing the impact of Michael's words.
I've brought some lists, starting with Bristol. When I typed ketamine in, about 100 names appeared. I need you to look at them to see if any names are familiar.
Why would they be? Asks Ted.
A name you might have heard Naomi mention in passing, for example, or a friend of the boys.
I doubt she often came into contact with criminal drug users, Ted says dryly.
Naomi stole drugs. So did Ed. I turn to face Ted, my voice rising. How can he still believe so implicitly in his children's innocence? Of course they came into contact with criminal drug users. There is a silence. Ted pulls his arm back. As Michael looks down at his list, his cheeks are red. I feel a flash of disappointment. He is embarrassed because I lost my temper. I look away from both of them, out of the window to the grass and the sky and the trees. Michael hands identical papers to each of us.
Anything that jumps out at you for whatever reason would be useful to hear, he says.
Tom Abbott, Joseph Ackerman, Silas Ahmed, Jake Austin, Mike Baker. I read the names on the sheet. I've never seen any of them before. It's a relief, and it isn't. It means we are no further forward. Ted shakes his head.
Sorry, nothing rings a bell. I've got an even bigger list that takes in the Southwest.
Michael is pulling more papers from his bag. Ted starts reading down the new list. He reads quickly and turns the pages faster than I do. I want him to take longer, look more closely, but he's always read more quickly than me, cleanly taking what he needs from the text as though cutting it out. I read and reread, glancing at Michael, wanting to signal my gratitude, but he is reading the list as well, frowning slightly. He must be tired. I picture him going into his office earlier today, starting up the computer, printing the lists for us, driving to Dorset for 2 hours. His eyes would have been focused on the road, but what thoughts would have been in his head as the countryside flashed by? It seems strange that I have no idea at all. Ted has read through the new list before I finish. He puts it down.
No luck, he says briefly.
He walks into the kitchen and starts rummaging noisily through cupboards. I carry on reading, trying and testing each name. Nothing is familiar. Michael walks over to me and puts his hand on my shoulder. A machine whizzes from the kitchen, stops, and starts again. The heat from Michael's hand burns through to my skin. I close my eyes,
After a few seconds, he moves back to his briefcase and pulls out two thicker sheaves.
I've got a national list here.
My God, says Ted, reappearing with a tray of steaming mugs. You've cast the net wide. Michael takes a mug of soup and sips.
Thanks. I expect it's the same for you. When someone's sick and you're not sure why, you work through all the possibilities, all those blood tests and scans. Detective work.
Ted nods.
You've got a point. Sometimes it's just finding that extra bit of information, a different kind of headache, the smallest shift in electrolytes, or the most obscure shadow on the scan, and there's your diagnosis.
The soup is warm and spicy. Ted has learnt how to cook. For a second I see Beth, my image of Beth, flushed with heat from the stove, stirring a pan of soup. Ted leaning over to look, kissing her neck. My eyes hurt with reading the small type. I fetch the glasses I now need for close painting from the shed. When I come back into the room, Michael, noticing my glasses, gets up and switches on the light. Ted smiles at me.
So, my wife wears glasses nowadays. Suits you.
I sit down opposite him, on the chair next to Michael. Michael hands us the sheaves of paper.
This is the national list. Where the drug users are linked with other crimes, there is an asterisk by their name. This one covers Scotland, North England, the Midlands, East Anglia, Wales, and back down to the south, including London.
There must be thousands here, Ted says. I don't have to read thousands of names, though. It is there, on the second page down, with an asterisk by it. Josca. Josca Jones. That strange Christian name again. And I feel winded, as though I've been punched in the chest. He had a Welsh accent, I say slowly. That was odd.
Who did? Michael gets out of his chair and crouches by mine. What was odd?
His voice is urgent as he looks at me. It was odd because Josca isn't a Welsh name. Michael looks at the list of names I'm holding, scanning down quickly.
Josca Jones, you mean? You remember him?
I remember a man called Josca, I reply, looking down into Michael's face, and instead of his searching grey eyes, I see brown ones, in a narrow face, powerful hands, a slim, strong body, dark hair, high cheekbones. Then another picture replaces that, and just for a second I see her handwriting. X, Y, Z. The Y hidden between the X and the Z, drawn in red and touched by a heart. He would have warned her never to write his name anywhere.
What was the matter with him? Michael asks.
That's the thing. I never found out.
Why not? Didn't he say much? Was he difficult?
Michael's questions are fast, like bullets hitting into me. The opposite. He was charming.
Could you remember what he actually said?
Michael is looking at me hopefully. Ted, watching from the other side of the room, is shaking his head, and I can see he doesn't think I'll be able to reach that far back. Some bits, maybe, I tell Michael, but it was over a year ago. I remember that when he first walked in and sat down, he didn't look like he needed anything, and that was strange in itself. People usually looked ill when they came to see me, in pain or worried or sad. Josca's colour was good, and I think he was actually smiling, or at least his mouth was. Perhaps there had been a scar, a small one under his left eye, which made the rest of his face look even smoother. The brown eyes in the slim face had watched me very closely. He hadn't looked ill at all, just curious.
Write down what he said, if you can.
Michael reached into his bag and gave me a blank piece of paper, already neatly attached to a clipboard. He felt in his pocket for the pen he always carried.
It could be important. Write it down just as it happened.
Word for word?
You'll be surprised what can come out of your memory when you do this. Try.
Then he smiled, as if it would be the easiest thing in the world to remember a 7-minute consultation which happened over a year ago. It was the 2nd of November.
I know that for certain, because he came in before Jade, so the date is imprinted in my memory. I write the date at the top of my piece of paper and underline it. Then I write what I think we said, and in between I try to remember how it was. 2nd of November 2009. How can I help? I must have said something like that. I think I kept it brief. I can remember being in a hurry because I had got behind early on. He had leant towards me and put his hand on the table. I remember that clearly because patients didn't usually touch the table. It was my territory. Yoska's hand had been too close to mine, and I had taken my hand away. It had felt like a power game which he was winning. He'd been quick to answer. Back pain. Runs in the family. Back pain isn't usually genetic, but I sensed he wanted a reaction from me, so I didn't argue. What do you think brought this on? Sometimes patients don't like that question, thinking the doctor should know. They don't realize it's useful to have their opinion. Yoska didn't mind. His answer came as quickly as if he'd prepared it. Carrying my kid sister around. She likes to sit on my shoulders, but she's getting heavy. I could tell he didn't like it when I suggested he let his sister walk on her own. I had him down for the kind of man who didn't want to be told what to do, especially by a woman. His straight leg raising was limited on the left. I told him it was sciatica and gave him a script. I remember he smiled and shook my hand. I'd smiled back, relieved it had been simple after all. Michael scans through the dialogue I've written, and Ted gets up and reads it over his shoulder. Will it help? I look at Michael. Definitely. He nods emphatically. If it's the same Yoska as on my list, though it's a bit of a long shot, of course. It seems to have been a straightforward consultation, Ted says. It's hard to see how this could connect to Naomi. He walks to the sofa, sits down again, and begins to stroke his right eyebrow back and forth. I should be able to get a photograph from the database, Michael continues. I'll email you a copy if I do. Then what? I stare at him, feeling the little hope of the moment fade away. Even if the Yoska I saw in my surgery is the same man as Yoska the ketamine dealer on your list, what will that really prove? The red Y in the diary seems to fade as I speak, the little hearts evaporating into nothing. I can't say precisely yet, but it could give us something to work with. Michael smiles at me then. Step by little step. That's how it usually works, remember? Later that evening, I remember when he'd said that to me before, about little steps and how they get you there in the end. It was 11 days after she had gone, a time when I had thought we were going nowhere at all. Bristol, 2009. 11 days after. As we approached the bend in the road coming from Thornbury towards Oldbury-on-Severn, we saw the bollards and the yellow and blue of the parked police car shining brightly in the gloom of a winter afternoon. Already the light was going and the rain was falling hard. Michael stopped the jeep tight against the hedge, got out, and walked over to where a policeman was waiting. Through the raindrops on the windscreen, I watched them move towards each other, then walk together past the bollards and enter a field by the open gate, disappearing from sight up the puddled beginnings of a track. I was glad Ted was on call, and it was just Michael who had brought me in the police jeep. If Ted had been here, we would have been alone together now, waiting for Michael to come back, the fear becoming larger as it moved between us, or surfacing in angry words. Instead, he was with Ed, who was still in bed with a bandaged arm, and on hand for the hospital should he be called in for emergencies. I was here because of a compulsion to be where Naomi might have been since we last saw her. After a few minutes, Michael got back in the jeep, bringing with him the wet freshness of outside. His mouth had set in a grim line. The van's been left in a little copse to the side of the field, further up the slope. He nodded to the open gate and the field beyond that. His fingers tightened their grip on the wheel. What is it, Michael?
I asked him, but he was looking straight ahead. What's happened? He took a hand from the steering wheel and put it over both of mine as they twisted together on my lap.
It's been partly burnt out, he told me.
The warmth from his hands seeped into mine. For a moment I wanted to cling to them, but Michael leant forward and started the jeep again. We edged slowly towards the open gate, where the policeman pulled the bollards back and let us through. My head was full of her name, like a prayer, as the jeep lurched onto the rutted farm track, steadily climbing up the sloped land of the field. I took in the ditch by the hedge, the thick twiggy hedge, and the curving brown fields. The ditch had been neatly cut and was full of brown water. I thought of rats and the small dead things that might be under the surface. On a separate little rise, set back from the field, I could see a group of trees up ahead. From here it looked like any other brown clump of winter trees in South Gloucestershire, distanced by the misty air. Michael halted the jeep below the rise and got out. I followed him. It had stopped raining. The air was dank and cold, smelling of mud and wet grass. It was quiet after the noise of the engine, but the silence slowly filled up with the sound of starlings in the trees and the sudden harsh calls of crows circling far above. I could hear cattle a long way off, and the closer, quieter dripping of water as it came off the trees onto the ground. The grey sky was wide up here. We were higher than I had realised. We climbed up the steep bank, our feet sinking in a mulch of withered beech leaves, and then we stepped over the blue and white tape that was threaded through the trees. Scratchy undergrowth pulled at my legs, and I didn't see the van at first. It had been pushed under a lone conifer tree, and the charred lower branches were bare. The windows had gone, and the metal of the roof was blackened. I stood next to it, imagining the flames that did this, the heat that destroyed the skin of the van, the noise, and the smell. We walked round to the front, where the bonnet rested against a tree trunk. Fragments of blue paint were left, mostly peeling and stained black. The number plate had been wrenched off.
This part was less burnt, Michael explained. The petrol tank would have gone up first.
I want to see inside, Michael.
I thought you'd say that.
He went back to his car, pulled something from the boot, and returned with a pair of blue rubber gloves. I put them on, struggling to get the rubber over my wet fingers. The passenger door had gone. I leant inside and saw the wires and springs, all that was left of the seats. I put my hand into the empty socket where the radio had been. The glove compartment had been ripped out. I looked into the back seat, more wires and springs. The rain had come in, so that under the front seat was a big puddle, the water black. I couldn't see what might be under it, though it didn't look deep enough to hide anything. I put my hand down between the springs and brushed my fingers along the metal at the bottom of the van. I felt the skin of the van as carefully as I felt the skin of my patients. Nothing.
Why here? I said to Michael. It's so far away from anywhere. Not near a main road or a town or a railway station. There's no way to escape.
Not obvious, is it? Michael said. Excuse me a second. I need to make a couple of calls.
He walked away from me through the trees, bending over his mobile, and after a few moments I lost sight of him. I thought how in the spring this place would be quite different. There would be sun and shadows moving on the ground amongst the bluebells and wild garlic. The light would be green and gold as it came down through the beech leaves, and the little wood might feel like a cathedral. I heard the noise of the rain starting again as it fell on the leaves before I felt the drops on my head. It was darker now, and I wondered what noises there might be in the wood when the night came.
We need to go.
Michael had come back and was standing close to me.
There will be more of our men coming soon. The van has to go off for examination.
I stood there for a moment longer. What had been achieved after all? There was nothing in this burnt car, or in the woodland that brought me closer to Naomi. Nothing even to tell us if this was the car she had got into. Nothing, apart from a few flakes of blue paint. Has this all been a waste of time, Michael? We are no further forward at all. Michael gripped my hand for a second and let it go.
You're wrong there, Jenny. We are moving forward all the time, but you have to be patient. It's easier for me. I've been trained to do this. Remember, it's steps like this, one after another, which will get us there in the end.
But the steps are too small, I thought. It will take too long. All the same, the weight of disappointment seemed to shift just a little. What will happen now? I asked him.
The van will be taken to the forensics garage at the police headquarters in Portishead and examined inch by inch. All the findings will be kept, in case further information comes to light which makes them useful. That's how it works, you see, he said.
Coming out of the trees, I faced the view for the first time and saw how the green of the Severn estuary flattened out towards the broad river some 2 miles from where we stood on the hill. The water looked brown between the high muddy banks, where the bright hulls of sailing boats lay on their sides above the tide line. Away to the left, the lights of the new Severn Bridge glowed through the dusk.
Over there is Wales, Michael said,
and he nodded at the hills that looked close enough to touch, just the other side of the water.
27. Dorset, 2011. 13 months later. Coming back from the shop on Tuesday morning, I noticed Mary moving slowly through her garden, carrying handfuls of feathers. She looks at me over the wall.
Fox, she says, dug his way in.
Rounded shapes spill awkwardly from her grasp. Tubes twist through her gnarled fingers. Close up, these become the torn necks of 2 chickens. Behind her in the coop are piles of red-stained feathers. There are no soft background bird noises, no heads dipping and lifting. In the tar-smelling darkness of her neat toolshed, I reach down 2 spades from the shining rows hanging against the wall. We dig a deep hole in the corner of her vegetable patch, where the soil is softer. She tips in the 6 dead birds, their broken bodies bright against the walls of cold black soil. We trample the surface flat when we have filled in the hole. The images come, as I knew they would. They still flare and burn, though less often. Now it's her soft face that is under the soil. Mud is matting her hair. I step away quickly. Mary smiles at me as she takes my spade, and I wonder if she guesses what's on my mind.
At least the leeks will be tasty next year, she says. Blasted foxes.
Inside we sit together in silence, either side of her kitchen table. Sage and chives are bunched in a flowery teapot between us, and red, yellow and blue squares of knitting spill from a paper bag, to be taken to neighbours for sewing into mission blankets. The stack of empty egg boxes sits next to them. Her mouth purses round the lip of china, and she pushes a tin of biscuits towards me.
Sandy bought these for Christmas. Don't like them myself.
Mary's love for her daughter is buried deep. Sometimes I try to dig it out.
She probably made them, Mary. If they look homemade, that's because she bought them cheap at the school fair. She can't pull the wool over my eyes.
Then she adds, as if inconsequentially,
Dan liked meeting your boys. He's planning on staying with them in New York.
He told me. I reach out and rub a sage leaf between my fingers. He popped in the other evening. Mary's bright bird eyes half close against the steam from her cup.
The boy needs to get away.
Dan's face hovers between us.
My old man left some cash for him.
She nods at the photograph on top of the television.
For his education. Comes in handy now.
Deep-set eyes under thick eyebrows look sternly from the frame. He knew then that Dan might change. He must have watched and listened to his grandson, in the way that I didn't with my children. My regrets are just under the surface, waiting to emerge at any thought.
Mary gives a short laugh. Ha! Dan's in a bit of a fix with his feelings.
She looks at me sideways, thinks he's in love. She leans over, pats my hand. My cheeks feel hot, as though I am guilty of something.
Mary, for God's sake, is a child, like one of mine. You don't feel like a mother to him, that's all. Not your fault.
She stands, picks up the empty egg cartons, and drops them into her recycling bin. Later, as I paint in the shed, Dan's shadowed face, uncertain and unhappy, gets between me and the paper. I haven't seen Dan since he came to supper. He would never admit to being in love, wouldn't want to talk about any of it. He would turn his face away, crushed. Or am I wrong there, too? Does he want to talk about how he feels? I sit down on the bench, brushes in hand, and look out of the little window up to the grey, unmarked sky. What do I know about how much space a person needs around them? I thought Naomi had needed space, but perhaps that was what I wanted her to need. It was easier that way. I can think that was true as easily as I can think that, of course, it wasn't. Everything has started wavering again. Time had taken me somewhere I could manage, but now I am sliding back to where I used to be, since the drugs, since I saw the name Yoska again. I stand up and look at the scatter of seeds on the paper. I make my eyes take in the tiny red oval fruits of the haws, the black dots at the top. Slowly they become all there is, these little waiting pips of life, shuttered, small, secret. The buzz of the mobile breaks the silence. I've found a picture of Yoska Jones. Michael's voice sounds careful. It's not his real surname. He has several aliases.
What does he look like?
I hold the mobile as tightly as if it were Michael's hand.
Mid-twenties? Medium build?
Is it Michael's clipped policeman's description that makes me feel suddenly cold?
Olive complexion, brown eyes and hair.
I remember the slanting brown eyes that had watched my every move.
I did some investigating. Michael carries on. See you in a couple of hours.
He puts down the phone. My thoughts jump over each other, like Mary's chickens fluttering and scrambling in the dark to get away from the fox. What has he found out? If Yoska the patient turns out to be Yoska the drug dealer, and he was involved, does that make it better than if it was someone I don't know? If he was the one who took her, is that good or bad? Bad, answers the voice in my head. Bad. Bad. Could I have said something else in the surgery? If it was him, and I had asked him to come back, or if I had referred him, he might have been placated. What if I had asked him about the sister he mentioned and offered to help? In the house, I build a fire to welcome Michael. Theo's montage of photos catches the flickering light. The main photo in the centre always holds me. Her face seems full of secrets. Today I look at her mouth for the first time. I notice the lips have a little mocking twist. What about the photo before that one? In the corner, there is a photo full of orange leaves, the first in Theo's woodland series, and she is laughing, her face taken up with mouth and teeth, her eyes too difficult to see. The one before that? Her profile on a holiday. Her eyes are trained on something out of the picture, slightly narrowed. What had she been thinking? She had been quieter than usual, texting, reading, or hunched over her writing in the little book that she took everywhere. She hadn't fought with the boys so much. She hadn't come shopping with me. Ted had said she was moody. I look back further and see her at the New Year's Eve party the year before. Theo must have gone to collect the photos that were on my wall at work. I had noticed the intensity of her expression in this photo before, but now I see she looks even harder and more determined than I had realised. I sit down,
trembling. Had she been waiting to escape for a long time? And when her chance came, had she been so focused on getting away at last that she forgot to be careful and took the first dangerous opportunity that came her way? Michael knocks at the door. He comes in and kisses me briefly, his eyes preoccupied, his lips cold against mine. He takes his coat off slowly, as I wait for this second to pass, then the next. Soon he will show me. Soon I'll know. We go into the sitting room. He opens his case, pulls out the photo. I know him instantly. The slant to the eyes, high cheekbones, handsome even in a mugshot. I don't want it to be this man. He was too cunning, and his eyes had been so guarded. That's him, my patient. Then I say quickly, but even though this man came to see me, and even though we know he's a dealer in ketamine, that still makes it a long shot, surely.
Your surgery couldn't help because he was a temporary resident, and he'd failed to fill in the address. But there's another connection, says Michael. I know his face. I've seen him before.
How come? But of course, a drug dealer. The police must meet them time and again.
In the hospital.
What hospital?
Frenchay.
Ted's hospital.
He was part of a large family of gypos who kicked up in summer 2009.
Michael's voice is curt. I look at him, surprised. Travellers are often irrationally feared and despised. Michael is different, surely.
He continues. They created a fracas in the ward, started smashing up furniture, breaking computers. They took to breaking into local houses.
Why?
They were angry. An operation on a young girl in the family went wrong.
He stops, sits down on the sofa, takes my hand to pull me next to him.
A neurosurgical operation.
As he is saying it, even before, I know what he's talking about. Ted's voice had been low, monotonous. Was it June or July 2009? Something bad happened at work. It was my fault. He never usually said anything was his fault. I should have listened. I was stacking kit on our bed for the boys' Duke of Edinburgh expedition. They were going to the Atlas Mountains with the school. I had ticked the list as I collected the clothes. It was hot. Ted had come home unusually early and had lain on the bed, his tie pulled off, shirt sleeves rolled up. What was your fault, darling? I glanced at him as I walked to the drawers, lifting out thick socks, more comfortable inside climbing boots.
An operation on this little girl. She had Hurler syndrome. Her spine was narrowed. She had a hunchback.
His voice was so slow. I thought it was tiredness after a long day. He had been coming in later, working harder. I glanced at my list. Sun cream? Sun hats, woolly hats as well, because it gets cold in the mountains at night.
Hurler syndrome, that rings a bell. I turned to him for a moment. Lysosomal storage disease. Lacking an enzyme so abnormal, metabolites get stored everywhere. The spine, the liver.
I was surprised I could remember from my exams years ago. I think Ted stood up and paced then.
I let Martin do the op. He wanted the experience. It went wrong.
I kept my finger on the place I had got to on my list. That's bad. I added a fleece to each pile on the bed.
It's my fault, you see. They think it is, anyway.
He turned his head away, and I couldn't see his expression. His voice was so quiet.
Happened on my watch.
He sat down on the edge of the bed and put his face in his hands.
Might go to court.
That's horrible, darling. Poor family. It wasn't your fault, though. You'll be all right, you'll see. They'll realize you weren't to blame.
I sat next to him, resting the clothes on my lap. I couldn't see his face, so I took his hand. But I am to blame, morally and legally.
He moved his hand away after a while, and I stood up,
reluctant to leave the packing. I'm almost done here. Can you wait till supper? We'll talk about it then. Try not to worry. But while I was still sorting clothes, his mobile rang. He had to go back to the hospital. I had supper on my own. I thought we would talk about it again. Instead, it had quietly disappeared from view. It was Ted's case, wasn't it? I asked Michael fearfully.
Yes.
Shit, he was right then. Grudge holders, he had said. Doctors playing God.
What do you mean?
Way back, when I was making that chart of people we should question, Ted thought we ought to consider the possibility of revenge. He said you can easily make enemies, all it takes is one mistake. I can hardly breathe as I say these words. I remember saying I didn't think anyone would hate us that much. I get up to phone Ted, and he answers almost immediately.
I've finished my list, and I'm coming down now. I want to see the photograph.
Yes.
If it's him, then it's my fault.
His words come fast before he hangs up. I turn to Michael. You thought of this too? He frowns. I can see he is thinking back. A long time ago, you asked me to make a list of enemies, I continue. All I was able to come up with were Jade's father and Anya's husband. He nods, remembering, and I feel the burn of regret. What if I'd thought of Yoska then? My teeth start to knock together, my body shivers. I must have caught Ted's virus. Michael puts a glass of whiskey in my hand, and then he runs a hot bath for me. The warm water stops the shivering, and afterwards his arms are close round me. He kisses me and pulls me closer, but I feel too ill, too distressed to make love.